part four of our series on Esther. Part four's message is titled, The Plot to Kill God's People. It's found in Esther. We'll get to the scriptures in just a moment. It's in chapter 3, starting at verse 7. If you want to look that up, put your finger there. But let's take a review just before we get to the scripture and find out what's going on in today's portion of the book of Esther. King Xerxes, of course, is in power in Persia, and given all the countries he has conquered, he is now in charge of the entire Persian Empire, as it was known during this era. Now, Xerxes was a very wicked king. He had commanded his beautiful wife, Vashti, to strut her stuff in front of the 15,000 people who had gathered for the king's wild party that he threw, first of two. She promptly refused to obey the king. Now, the king's advisors, in retaliation to Queen Vashti's actions in refusing the king's command, convinced the king to confer an edict that refused to allow Vashti to enter his chambers ever again, or to even come before him in public or private ever again. And that edict also forced every man in the kingdom to become the ruler of his own household personally. My, what a change it made in that society as men became the king of the household. Not the husband, not the father, but the king, the ruler, the one who tells everybody what to say, what to do, and what not to say, and what not to do. Well, 4 years passed, and the advisors, the same group of clowns that talked him into getting rid of Vashti, now conned the king into throwing a wild beauty pageant, if we want to call it that in 21st century terms. It was an attempt to find the most beautiful, talented, and wonderful woman, the woman that caught the king's eye, to become the replacement for Vashti. Some 400 finalists went before the king, and before they could go before the king and have their one-night stand with the king, they had to go through at least a year of preparation. It included makeup and oils and perfumes and diet. Incredibly strict dieting. That body had to be perfected, and it was done so by a group of eunuchs who monitored these women. And only the best of them would ever have that opportunity. The Bible doesn't tell us how many of the 400 finally got there before it came to Vashti, before it came to Esther, but we know for sure that Esther had been there for a good long time. She was on down the list somewhere. But after Esther had her night with the king, after she had that one night with the king, all of a sudden, he wasn't interested in the other women. Esther caught the king's eye, and he asked for her to come back and come back and come back to his chamber. Unlike the other women, who never had the opportunity to go back twice because the king had to invite them after the first time. And now we see that Esther has been chosen queen and the two are wed. Now, not only was she promoted to be the queen, she was encouraged that whole time by her adoptive father, who actually was her first cousin by blood, Mordecai, who had raised her from childhood. He had encouraged her to hide her Jewish identity and her real name of Hadassah and become Esther, just a common woman who would fit the king's needs. Mordecai himself, a devout Jew most of his earlier life, hid his own identity as being Jewish. He was promoted in the kingdom and moved on up. And as part of his promotion, he saw some things that were happening in the kingdom. For example, the big one was when he heard a plot to assassinate the king. He heard the eunuchs talking about it, those who were working under his supervision, guarding the very entrance to the palace of the king. Very close to the king they were. And these eunuchs who had access to the king himself, they could get into the palace for good, wholesome reasons, but with evil motives. They were planning to kill the king. And Mordecai heard it. And Mordecai debated about what to do, and finally he did the right thing, and he told his adoptive daughter, he told the queen, Esther, what was about to happen. Esther told the king of the plot and how she found out about it. Mordecai was praised, and the eunuchs were assassinated in a horrible fashion. They were impaled on a sharpened pole. Horrible way to die. But that wasn't the end of it, because a new fellow by the name of Haman was appointed to be the king's number one general, if you want to call him that. The closest aide to the king, the closest man there was to the king. He was as wicked as was Xerxes, the king. And he himself hated the Jews. He demanded all the Jews would bow when he passed. He rode in a chariot that was held up high so that everybody standing there had to look up to him in order to see him. You couldn't look down and see him. Same as the king. The king had the same problem. He had an ego that was bigger than Texas in those days. So did Haman. But one man finally stood up and did the right thing. That man was Mordecai, the same fellow who had been hiding his Jewish descent and instructing his adoptive daughter to hide hers and become the king's wife, the queen. Esther and Mordecai both hid the fact that they were Jews. Why? Because there were people there that hated the Jews. Xerxes himself hated the Jews, but he tolerated them because they were in captivity, until Haman came along and decided it was time to get rid of the Jews. And that's where we pick up on today's message. The Jews were persecuted under King Xerxes because of Haman. Chapter 3, verse 7, we begin with the reading of God's word. In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month of the year, by the way, their calendar's very different than ours. Their first month of the year is the one we now call April. That was the first month. The month of Nisan, the Purim, now the Purim is the lots that were cast. Purim is the lot that was cast in the presence of Haman to select a day and a month that this plan should go forth. The lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. That's March the 7th, almost a year from the date the lots were cast. So now you get a picture of the calendar and how the events are shaping up. Now, once this was done, Haman said to King Xerxes, "There's a certain people dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom who keep themselves separate." He's referring to the Jews. "Their customs are different from those of all the other people, and they do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them any longer. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy these people. And I will give 10,000 talents of silver to the king's administrators, to the royal treasury." So the king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Now you see the plot thickens. An enemy of the Jews, who is now the first general of the king, has convinced the king to kill all the Jews and let him do it. So on the 12th day of the first month, the royal secretaries were summoned. They wrote out the script of each province and the language of all people, of Haman's orders, of the king's satraps, the governors of the various provinces, and the nobles of the various people. They were written in the name of King Xerxes himself and sealed with his own signet ring. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, March, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so they'd be ready for that day. The couriers went out and, spurred on by the king's command, and the edict was issued to the entire citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered. Well, we find out that here in the month of April, during the 12th year of King Xerxes' rule over the Persian Empire, lots were cast in Haman's presence. These lots, as we said, were called Purim, to determine the best day and time in the month to take action against the Jews. Haman wanted it all done in a single day. He didn't want to drag it out. You see, I can only imagine why that was. I want you to think about that for just a minute. Why would Haman want all of this evil to be done on the same day? Well, if you stop and think about it, if it had been spread out even over a week, over 7 days, for example, if it had been spread out, by the time they got to the second day, sympathy for the Jews would have built up. There would have been time for people to encourage the king to stop the slaughter, because these people are innocent. They're not hurting the king, and the king then would have turned against Haman and his advisors who had talked him into this horrific idea. And so Haman chose to convince the king to do it all in the same day. And so the edict goes out to all of the governors, and they're all getting prepared for it. But Susa was rather perplexed by the whole thing. Verse 8 says, Haman approached King Xerxes and told him about the certain race of people scattered through the provinces of your empire who keep themselves separate from everyone else. Their laws are different from any of the other people, and they refuse to obey the laws of the king. Now, he's specifically talking about Mordecai, but he's also talking about the Jews who still have Jewish celebrations going on in their privacy. Now, can you draw any parallels? We've drawn parallels from the book of Esther in America since we've been started. Do you see a parallel happening in the U.S. right now over that very situation? Churches meet privately, and in the United States of America, as long as we're in this building, we have the right to meet privately. But if we decided one day we're going to stream our services, or to do what I'm doing and broadcast them, and somebody hears one of those messages, and I happen to make a statement that they're offended by when I'm referring to such hot topics in the United States of America these days as human sexuality and what God teaches about it, or if I were to say something about abortion being murder, it being a human being that's in the womb, you need to write that down. You really ought to put it on your refrigerator. Satan hates me. Write it down in big letters and put it up there. The next time he tempts you, you remember that. When Satan is tempting you, he's not trying to help you get some enjoyment out of life, as he tells you he's doing. He's not even trying to give you sin as a pleasure for a season. What he's trying to do is devour you. He's like a Lay's potato chip. You can't do just one. You can't commit just one sin and slip it under the rug and nobody know it without doing it again. Prove me wrong. Well, Haman approaches the king and wants to destroy all the Jews. He already hated the Jews. He's a little bit like Satan. You know, I don't doubt for one minute that evil people like Xerxes and Haman, in more modern days, Adolf Hitler, and many of the other evil dictators that are living today are not directly controlled by Satan himself. You know, it might even be that if there is a person on planet Earth who really, truly is possessed by Satan, it's these people. But demon oppression is where all of us who have demons that harass us, there's where the demonic influence comes into your life. You have demonic influence because you're being harassed by demons. And when you're harassed by demons, that's where the temptation is coming from. That's where the whole thing about this little devil sitting on your shoulder saying to you, oh, you know you want to do it.
Why don't you give in?
That's where that's coming from. You ever met Satan himself? No, you're not sitting next to him. I don't care what you think. Satan is not in a human body. Satan is alive and well. And he might very well be in the room where you are, but his demons are doing most of the work for him. Only at special times and special places, like evil leaders, does Satan himself deal with those people. But Satan has used his evil to control these people to do his will. Haman was one of these men that I believe was possessed, determined to kill the Jews. And he deliberately misled the king. Oh, now let's understand something here. How is it that one possessed person could mislead another possessed person? Is that possible? You got to remember, you're not dealing with God here. You're dealing with Satan. And Satan hated both of them just as much as he hates you. Why did he do what he did? Because Satan was trying to devour the Jews any way he could. So yes, he had Haman deceive King Xerxes. And he convinced him that they had to do this evil thing on this special day. And he must have been very convincing because the king bought it. And now we see in verse 9, he said, if it please the king, issue the decree that they, the Jews, be destroyed. Then he says, I'm going to promise 10,000 large sackfuls of silver that he took from the people he killed. Well, in verse 10, the king agreed. He went along with the plan. He confirmed his decision by removing his signet ring and handed it to Haman. That's a rare move. Do you understand what's happening here? The signet ring was the promise of the king. If you signed an original document in today's time, if you want a formal document to be legally binding, you have it notarized. You have a person who is bonded and licensed by the state to notarize your signature. And they stamp it, sign it, and put all the information there that verifies this is a legal document and this person before me is the person who signed it. That's what a signet ring did in those days. Usually it was a glob of wax that was dropped onto a document, and that signet ring had a unique, one-of-a-kind stamp cut in the top of it. And it would stamp down in that hot wax, and when it was pulled out, it would be in the shape of the signet ring. And it was known that it was the king's signet ring. Do you know that the tomb of Christ was sealed the same way? The Bible doesn't talk about a signet ring there, but it was sealed. And according to Roman tradition, they sealed it with a wax bead, and the king's signet ring imprinted all the way around the bead so that if it was broken and the stone put back in place, there could be no theft of the body and nobody know about it because the seal had been broken. Interesting stuff, isn't it? You get to realizing here all of a sudden that you've got two forces on this planet. And it's a whole lot more than we try to define by saying good versus evil. That don't get it done, folks. If you say good is God and evil is Satan, then you're getting closer to getting it done. Because the only good that comes on this planet came from God, originated with Him, and it originated when He created you. You were not created to be a little demon. If you became a little demon, you chose to become that demon because you were lied to and you bought the story of what was happening. Now, in addition to all of this, we see that the Persians were upset by all of this as well. Now, paraphrasing the scriptures, here's what happened. On April the 17th, a decree was written, sealed with the king's signet ring. It was swiftly sent out to the provinces of Persia. The decree stated that on March the 7th of the following year, almost a year later, that all of the Jews, young and old, including women and children, babies and grandpas and grandmas, would all be killed, slaughtered, annihilated on a single day. The property of the Jews would be given to those who assassinated them. And it ends by telling us the king and Haman sat down to drink. The city of Susa fell into confusion. Now imagine that. Every single Jewish person in the whole empire put to death. 15 million people approximately put to death on one day. You imagine an entire state in the United States of America and the government saying everybody in that state's going to be killed this day. Or what about if they said everybody who's left-handed in the United States of America is going to be killed on this certain day? You know anybody left-handed? Are you left-handed? I've got a son that's left-handed. Are you? You know anybody? Imagine they're going to be put to death on the same day. How would you feel about that? Would you like it? Well, how would you feel if every Jew in the United States of America on a certain date was going to be put to death? When you start taking people's lives because you don't like who they are, like Haman was trying to do, you take the place of God and say, I know more than God, and I'm going to put these people to death. There's one exception to that. The Bible clearly allows capital punishment. I don't know how you feel about it or whether you believe in it or not, but the Bible clearly allows it. That punishment for that person who has done a crime so egregious that they can't be trusted in society, the Bible says they should be put to death. That's about it in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, God himself actually commanded that evil people be put to death. But that was before Christ came and died on a cross, that everybody in the world had the opportunity to serve the Lord. In the Old Testament, not everybody could serve the Lord because they didn't have the option to walk away. They didn't have the Holy Spirit directing them as he does in the New Testament because sin separated God from man. And it was only when God, through his Son, reconnected that we understand. And now in the New Testament, it's wrong to decide genocide for anybody, be it three people, one person, or millions through death in a gas chamber. It's unimaginable that people should be persecuted in the world, but persecution lives on. Well, how did the king and Haman react? They relaxed and started drinking. I sort of picture them drinking the equivalent of what we would call a pint, or two, or three, or a half a dozen, and maybe getting roaring drunk before they quit, while everybody else is perplexed. They're rejoicing and getting drunk. There are many true stories that I could share with you about the heroes of the faith, all of those who have stood firm even in the face of death, but there are only a few that I can put in a category of having experienced the worst of conditions in our lifetimes and in recent times. And I'm talking about the Holocaust. I'm talking about being exterminated because you were born Jew or because you were born with a handicap. If you were deaf or blind or if you had some other handicap, you were put to death because you were imperfect. Imagine what it was like to live during the day of the Holocaust. Imagine what it would be like to have a child who is born with a defect of some kind, being deaf or being born without one leg, or even in those days being born with a cleft palate, which we know how to fix easily now, or being born Jew. Imagine the fear that people lived in. I want to share one story about a woman that speaks a lot. Her name was Gloria Finkelstein. She died a few years ago at age 90. She left behind generations of loved ones, and her harrowing story all started with her own personal sacrifice. When Goldie was 13, it was in March of 1943, she and her older sister were grabbed off the street by Nazis to be sent to a forced labor camp. Her father was able to bribe the authorities to release his daughters, but when they got to the gate to be freed, a senior Nazi SS officer said to her father, "Two sisters? Only one can go, and you have to make the choice, which one?" Her father was unable to choose between his two daughters, and so Goldie volunteered to stay so her sister could go back home. Goldie was sent to a slave labor camp called Graben, where she and other young women were forced to manufacture textiles for the Nazi military. Goldie survived a death march in the winter of 1945 from Graben to the concentration camp at Bergen-Belsen, where she was liberated later on in April 15th of 1945. She learned after liberation that her entire family had been deported to Auschwitz in August of 1943, where they were gassed and burned within hours of arrival at that facility. Goldie was left alone at age 15 years, the sole survivor of her immediate and her extended family. But Goldie built a new life in America after she grew up. After her liberation, she met her future husband, Sol, also a concentration camp survivor in a displaced persons camp at Stuttgart, Germany. They were married for 66 years until Sol's death in June of 2013. They came to the United States as refugees in 1948, and after a brief time in New York City, they moved to Vineland, where they rebuilt their lives as chicken and egg processors. They had three children, and Goldie was totally devoted to rebuild the Jewish lifestyle, and she was also devoted to her family. Imagine what that would be like in your life. Imagine starting out as a 13-year-old child and being forced to make a choice like that, going to a concentration camp where you knew you probably were going to die, and thinking that her sister was going to live by making that choice, only to realize later on that you were the one who survived and your sister perished along with your parents. Imagine how it feels. The sacrifice made of those who do the right thing are sometimes very big. And the sacrifice that is made that's repaid by evil is always blessed of God by good in the end. Goldie and her husband Sol made a good life for themselves in America, and they were able to rebuild their Jewish tradition within their families and their community. The people she reached are just, the numbers are staggering. She's a woman who believed in God. She's a woman who put her faith in God, and a woman who faced the most evil that there has been, at least that we know of in our lifetimes, and our parents' lifetimes, and our grandparents' lifetimes. Oh yeah, there's other evils that took place, but none that went on as far as it did and driven by the same kind of hatred that drove the concentration camps and drove the wicked man Adolf Hitler, whom I believe was possessed of Satan. I ask you a question today. If persecution comes your way, will you give in, or will you stand for Christ? Will you take a stand even though somebody is saying to you you're going to die? All you have to do to die is just tell me that you are worshiping this man called Jesus. You want to live? Denounce him and you walk out. Which one will you do? Will you take your last breath as you say to him, I will never denounce Christ? Or will you have to live with the choice you make when you say, I don't know him? You know, in a lot of ways, we make that same choice every day. In small things, in times when we need to share our faith with others. Persecution is minor, all the way down to being laughed at because you're a Christian when you're in school. I remember those days, do you? I remember trying to talk to people about Christ. And I remember sitting in the 9th grade math class when my teacher, Mrs. Stedman, a dedicated Christian, asked point blank in the class, you couldn't do this today. She asked point blank, how many of you are Christians here in this room? I'd just like to know. I didn't raise my hand. My friend and my neighbor, Anthony, who was talking all the time about how he struggles to be a Christian and how he fights with all the stuff around him, he stuck that hand high in the air and he said, I'm not perfect, but I'm trying, and I love God with everything in me. He said it out loud. And I thought, as I bowed my head in shame, I should have been that one, but I wasn't. Where are you? You deal with some kind of persecution regularly. How you doing on the little stuff? See, those who are faithful in the small things will what? be ruler over the large things. If you can't break through the little persecution we have of being labeled as a Christian, a goody two shoes or whatever they want to call you, a Bible thumper, if you can't get past the little persecutions, what makes you think you can get by with the idea that one day somebody's going to have a pistol pointed at your head and saying, go ahead now, are you a Christian? That choice is ours. Make the small choice. Start right where you are today. Start this minute. Ask God to help you to overcome persecution.
It was a life filled with aimless desperation, without hope, walked the shell of a man. Oh, but then a hand with a nail print stretched downward. Just one touch, then a new life began. And the old rugged cross made the difference in a life bound for heartache and defeat. I will pray. Little feet ran in terror to hide. Oh, but now those walls ring with love, warmth, and laughter. A room filled with sad, ashen faces, without hope, death has wrapped them in gloom. Oh, but at the side we
Thank you for listening to Sunday Worship here on Joy Christian Radio. Sunday Worship is heard at 11 a.m. and again at 6 p.m. Central every Sunday here on all of our Joy Christian Radio FM stations and online at classicgospel.net. You can also hear today's sermon on the podcast. Just go to the website, joychristianradio.com, and click on podcast. This program is made possible because of the gifts from our supporters who believe in the ministry of Joy Christian Radio as we spread the hope of the gospel to the world via the internet and social media. You can mail a tax-deductible contribution of support to Post Office Box 6, Quitman, Mississippi, 39355, or support via electronic means at the website. That address again is joychristianradio.com. Click on the support tab to make your contribution. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support of Sunday Worship, a presentation of Joy Christian Radio and Joy Christian Ministries.